I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Wild Ones podcast, Listeners Takeover Edition. In the previous two episodes, we had Mechanic Nick and Coach James. We asked you guys to send us some questions for them, and we got so many great ones that we couldn't fit them all into one episode. So we've decided to put them together into a dedicated episode. We've got loads of interesting topics lined up, so stick around and don't worry, we'll be back to the regular format from next week. And with that, it's over to Nick and James. Enjoy. Question from Mark. I'm considering converting to tubeless tyres on my gravel bike. I know Nick loves them, but it also seems like they just don't work for some people. In the hope of eliminating user error, I'd love to know, in his experience, what are the most common tubeless setup and user errors people are making?
So, tubeless is a weird one. The problem with it is it's been very dominant to mountain bike for years and years and years. I mean, I remember doing it when I was a kid. But for road and for gravel, everything has gotten massively better over the last 3 years. So most people saying they have problems with it tend to either have one of the three, old tires, old wheels, or old sealant. All of that's massively improved over the last 3 years.
When you say old, you just mean...
developed before technology slightly caught on.
It is the equivalent of having like an iPhone 8 versus an iPhone 15.
Exactly. So it's nothing wrong with it, and it can work, and there'll be loads of people that have made it work, but that's essentially getting the golden triangle right of sealant tires and wheels.
Yep.
So the problem is going to be size of the tires, size of the wheels, and then how strong the sealant is in terms of sealing above a set PSI. So for gravel generally and mountain bikes, you run really low pressures, below 40 usually.
You always shout at me for running too high a pressure on my tubeless setups.
For road, you generally run higher. I know hookless is different, but we'll ignore that for a minute and just go off the basis of generally at 60 PSI and above for road. Most sealants won't work for that or never used to. But there's a lot of new stuff and technology has come out over the last few years that's improved that. So we still see tires coming to the shop where it's older stuff. And we struggle to set them up tubeless. And generally speaking, it's going to be the tire slightly too loose and the wheel is slightly too small. So they started this new thing called the ERTO standard, E-R-T-O, and most of the manufacturers now are building the wheels to that standard, making everything easier. So what I would say is if you're going to do it at home, the first thing is get your tire on the wheel without any sealant and see if you can seat it on first before you do it. So like essentially dry seating.
So seating is basically getting the bead of the tire into the nubbin of the rim.
Yeah. If it's dry seating properly, then you know it's going to work. Then you can throw your sealant in and it's easy. If it's not dry seating, generally speaking, either your tire is going to be slightly too big and your wheel slightly too small. So I would suggest then in that case, try and put a bit of extra tubeless tape on to kind of bulk out the tire. But you don't want to do more than I would say 3 times around the wheel. Otherwise, you're going to compromise the fit of the tire and the rim. The most important thing above all of this is going to be pick a good sealant, which I know is hard because there's loads of ones out there. But personally, from experience, Effetto Mariposa makes a good one. Stans Race is good. I really like the new Mulkit stuff. I've been trying that. Squirt with a bead blocker works well. And the best sealant, but unfortunately really expensive, is Silka. I've never found anything works as well as that. Nothing comes close to it either. But there is a price penalty.
We should probably say Cade Media is sponsored by Silka. However, you are not.
No, but we're using the shop for all road. Yes.
Are you sell other sorts of sealants
in
the shop as
well?
Yes,
we do three different sealants in the shop at the moment. We do squirt.
We have not forced him to say any of this.
We do Mulkit, and then we use. But the basic thing is we've got access to all the sealants. We don't use it because anybody's giving us any deals or anything. We use it because we've tried all the different things and that works best. I look back, we did 288 tubeless setups last year in the shop. There's only two of us in the shop, so it's a small shop.
So are you using the same sealant for road versus gravel?
No. So I use Silka for road, for all road going forward, just because that will seal at a much higher pressure. It's got strands of carbon fiber in it. It makes like a little mini nest. So sealing-wise, it just works better. You can get away with all the other sealants for gravel because the pressures aren't as high, so you don't have to worry as much, it'll seal. But on road, we just figured that most of the sealants just don't work nearly as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that probably a lot of people won't have even considered is because road is a higher pressure, therefore, when it's trying to stop, it's trying to literally block a hole in a tire, there's obviously more air pressure just pushing it out rather than giving it a chance to seal. Yeah, that makes loads of sense.
And that's how all the race sealants work. So like Stan's Race has got an additive in it. Effetto Mariposa, you can add an additive. Squirt's got a thing called bead blocker in. But the downside to some of them are like Stan's Race, after they say you should only use it on race days. The rest of the time you should use normal sealant. So it gives you extra
weird
stuff. Yeah, it's thick.
Is there any errors that people make with like valves or anything like that?
Valves aren't too tight, or they aren't tight enough, or they're too tight. The problem with this is a bit of it's a minefield. I would generally recommend going for your first setup to a proper shop that's done a few of these.
Yeah.
When I say proper shop, I mean like a shop that's experienced in tubeless. And then so they can kind of see, and that'll be a good indication, because if they do it easily, it'll be easy for you to do that, or if they've got massive issues.
I guess as well, your well-respected local bike shop or well-reviewed local bike shop will probably have preferences or experiences themselves. For example, my tubeless setup, you've basically said, get these wheels, get these tires, use this sealant. And I just go, yeah, okay, cool. Because I know you are making a good decision on my behalf.
It makes my life easier.
Yeah.
I mean, we did the video we did last year with the JGM, we fitted Conti's new GP5000, because that's re-release him, onto the Zips, the 404s, and we fitted them with a track pump. It's just really easy. So, but it is a bit of, it's a minefield. It's just the more modern wheels, when I say modern, released in the last 3 years, and the more modern tires also released in the last 2 to 3 years tend to work better together.
Actually, adding to that, these are your tips that you've told me. Another common error is you're not re-topping up your sealant. So you told me, put a calendar reminder in your calendar for once a month to remind you to re-top up your sealant.
Yeah. Because every three months,
correct. Yeah, yeah. I haven't been riding on it, so I haven't been doing that. But there was at one point a calendar reminder in my phone every 3 months to remind me to re-top up my sealant. And what's the reason for that?
Generally, sealant dries out after about 3 months. There's different companies claim different things, but what we've noticed is, generally speaking, it's 3 months. And then, I don't know if I can, but I can list you a set of tires that just don't work tubeless very well. The old ones, so the old Vittorias didn't work very well. The new ones are excellent. The old Contis, some of them were too tight, so certain wheels. It's a bit of a thing. Schwalbe tires, generally speaking, I've never really struggled with. They always work well. We don't sell them in the shop, but we've had customers bring them in. Terravel, really good for tubeless.
The other tip that you have given me is buy plugs. So ultimately, how do you, ultimately you can have the best setup. However, just like with tubes, you will occasionally get punctures that don't reseal or whatever, and you have to then be able to deal with it. And I think that's something that worries people as well, of how to deal with it.
That's actually the most important bit of tubeless. The biggest misconception of tubeless is that it's a foolproof solution. I can tell you now, it's not going to seal all punctures, but But you don't need it to seal all punctures. If it seals one puncture, it's one time where you didn't have to stop, flip your bike upside down next to the road, take the wheel off, get covered in oil and muck and everything like that. Try and find, get your tire off, inner tube out, find what's punctured it.
All right, we know how horrible it is to change a puncture. Yeah.
So essentially, if it seals once, it saves you from that and it's worth it. But generally speaking, with most sealants, the one we've run the longest was the Effetto Mariposa and Stans. They're very similar to each other. And we would say for gravel, it'll seal 8 out of 10 punctures. If it doesn't seal, make sure you have something that can plug it. So you get different plug tools. Loads of companies make them. We sell the Dynaplug ones just purely because that's the easiest. It's the least amount of...
I'm hearing a lot of hype on Dynaplug at the minute.
It's just easy. It's so incredibly easy. And that's, I think, the thing where you don't have to think. It's not teaching somebody how to ream out the hole, how to thread the little thing through, force. It's literally stick it in, pull it out.
It's done.
And you can put several in. So that's easier. It's more expensive, but trust me, next to the road, that's what you're going to want.
Do you carry a spare tube just in case?
No. I'm not going to advise you not to do that because there is cases where if everything's gone wrong, you can. That's the beauty of tubeless. If everything goes horribly wrong and nothing works, you're just back to square one where you would have been with the tube. Fits in your inner tube. That's the only value I see out of these TPU inner tubes. The Tubelitos and things like that, a few brands do them, is that they're really light to carry. So if you're
just small, regardless of the weight, they're so tiny when they're packed up that it just doesn't take up much space, does it? Question from Max. Love the podcast. I have a question for James about factoring weight training into a cycling training regime. I'm an avid gym goer and I used to powerlift. Since COVID, I've also moved into cycling. I don't want to lose too much strength or my muscle mass, but also want to improve my cycling and drop a few kilos. I was wondering if you have any guidance about how to organize my training around work and how I should focus my workouts to benefit both. Thanks, Max.
So I think firstly, it's important to be clear on what the priorities are in that phase of training. So if you're currently doing, because I think it was 3 strength training sessions alongside.
Yeah, so he says weekly he has 1 rest day. So he's doing exercise 6 days a week, which is a lot. 3 of those are full body bodybuilding workouts at the gym. He does 2 cycling training sessions, so specific training sessions, and then 1 long bike ride.
Mm-hmm. So I think maybe if the priority moves to, well, if essentially he wants to kind of lose weight or change his body composition, then potentially look at maybe altering the number of sessions. So change 1 of the hypertrophy sessions to a cycling session. So change that ratio. And then obviously when it comes to kind of weight management and that side of things, also think about it in terms of diet. So any recommendation I make based on diet is more like a longer term routine change rather than kind of creating like this boom and bust cycle where it's like 1 week it's fasting and really restricting calories on certain days. And essentially, yeah, creating something that isn't sustainable longer term, because I say, yes, that may work kind of for a couple of weeks to lose a couple of kilos here and there. But also at some point you're going to default back to the normal routine and the weight will come back on. So I think look at creating a sustainable routine. And I think, obviously there's a lot written about in terms of nutrition. I think I mentioned him before, Will Gerling, obviously has a couple of really good podcasts that speak more in depth, and obviously he's far more knowledgeable than I am on that topic. But I mean, there was something he said that was essentially, he was speaking around tying like calorie deficits into days where you're not doing as much training. So essentially making sure you're fueling training as well as possible. And to add to that as well, I think in general, eating a slightly more protein orientated diet, so kind of regular sources of protein throughout the day tied in with nutrient dense food, and then thinking about healthy fats amongst that as well, but then alongside that matching carbohydrate to essentially kind of energy demand from sessions. So if there's kind of a particularly long day or a harder day, high intensity day, have a bit more carbohydrate beforehand, during and after those. And outside of that, it's not necessarily no carbs. It's more just as a proportion of the plate, slightly reducing that. So, yeah, I think there's a few.
I've had a lot of conversations with Will Gerling over the years about nutrition in general, because it's something I've had a huge passion in for a long time. And he's an expert in that space. He's done loads of like academic stuff and things, and loads, honestly, like his knowledge is unbelievable. And the simple crux of it is, if you want to lose weight, you need to expend more energy than you're consuming.
100%.
But like you're just touching on, if you go extreme, it is just so hard for it to stick and for it to be like a realistic thing that sticks around for a period of time.
Yeah, I think there's one more point to make as well. Actually, it's kind of on that topic of reducing calories. There's actually it's quite a funny graph I've seen that was produced by Asker Jukendrop. I may have butchered his surname there, but he's another expert in the nutrition world. He's working with Visma Elitebike. So he's got a graph which is essentially, on one side is kind of a list of various different diets, whether that's paleo, vegetarian, whatever it is, some form of restriction in the diet. And there's an explanation next to it on why the diet works. And then every single one, it's creating a calorie deficit.
Yeah.
So essentially it's just, if next week, for example, I haven't got any restrictions on my diet currently, but if next week I was vegetarian, or invariably I'd just remove the meat from my diet, and then you'd struggle to replace that initially, and therefore I'd create a calorie deficit. So I may have a short-term effect, but then longer term, you just find something else to replace it with.
Yep.
And then you end up back to where you were.
So. Typically bread. So he's talking about organizing his training in his week. Is doing one long ride and two workouts sufficient for him to get, like, you know, he says he wants to be better at riding his bike. Is that enough?
I'd say so. Ultimately, I think it comes back to that first point on what is the priority.
Yeah.
So ultimately, another session would potentially be better if he's looking to kind of progress things on the bike. But yeah, the whole time it's about balance. So I think I used the analogy before where it's kind of talking about spinning plates. So it's like, yeah, it is difficult to kind of get everything. It's impossible to kind of optimize absolutely every area all at one time. So what I'd perhaps encourage is thinking about it more in terms of blocks of training. So maybe do a 4 to 6 week block where the focus is more on bike related sessions.
So say, for example, drop one of the gym sessions, mm-hmm. to boost his cycling performance.
Exactly.
And then the following block, he might then want to go back the other way. And
exactly. So it's kind of
a cycle, isn't it?
Yeah. At the end of the day. So move one area to maintenance. And I say you can do that with different areas you're trying to develop on the bike as well.
Yep.
So yeah, maintain in one area and progress in another area.
And I'm going to assume that if he's an avid powerlifter, like, you would assume that he's got a fairly good understanding of his body and his ability, mm-hmm. Cardio or not. So he's probably going to be able to just kind of work that out and do it himself, mm-hmm. I would have thought. Next one. My name is Eric and I hail from snowy Edmonton, Alberta in Canada. I just recently purchased a belt drive gravel bike, the Apollo, by Priority Bicycles. I bike mainly as a commuter, going on urban rides with my young family and the occasional longer ride with friends. Living where I do, where temperatures can range from 30 degrees above to 30 degrees below, I need a bike that could handle all weather conditions, including rain, dust, gravel, snow, and salt. With a Shimano Elfine 11 gear internal rear hub and the Gates carbon belt drive, this should handle it all. With no lube to put on the chain and only the need for a quick hose down after a dirty ride, wondering what your thoughts are on belt drive gravel bikes, or belt drives in general, are they underrated or overrated?
Now, Jimmy and I have been talking about this constantly every single day, probably for the last 2 months before this question came in, because we are contemplating the ultimate commuter bike for the two of us. Something that's going to use the least amount of maintenance.
So yeah, we discussed it in a podcast when you did your residency in January. And we ultimately, off the back of that, we enjoyed the conversation so much. We've just been kind of trying to work out if we can actually make it happen. I'm not convinced belt drive is the way to go. I've talked to some people about it. Some people are suggesting that belt drives in bad weather can slip.
So, yes. So we actually spoke to...
Maybe don't name them.
We spoke to a rep from a company over here that sells probably one of the main components needed in this belt drive. And they recommend not going for belt, going for the chain. And then that made me think quite a bit, because I like the idea they're always advertised that the carbon belt's going to outlive the bike, but that's not true. The belt doesn't last that much longer. It does, but like chain wise. So personally speaking, the other thing that I've seen as well, I've ridden some of them like just on like demo rides and test rides, is that if it gets dirty, it makes like a grinding feeling when you pedal, which can put some people off. Obviously, they are good, but I just feel there's too much needed. You need a frame that can be split to put the belt in. The belt needs to be made to accept exact length. So if you do need a new belt, you need to get the same one, make sure somebody stocks it. It might be easier in Canada where they've got more of that, but around here in Newcastle, you're going to struggle to get that belt straight away.
The bit with this that I am very into is the internal rear hub.
That's meant. I think that's brilliant.
But I think I would run it with a...
Single speed chain,
because like fixie chain.
Single speed chains last incredibly long. Yeah,
they are heavy and thick and chunky, and they just last forever.
And the oil wouldn't be an issue, because you can oil it, you can over oil it. Something we recommend not doing on geared bikes, yeah. But on this, because it's only going to run along your chain ring and along a cog at the back. There's no mechs or jockey wheels or things like that that's going to get caked.
It's just a clean chain.
Incredibly easy to clean. You're not going to struggle. Yes, it's a slight bit more maintenance than the carbon, but I think it's going to run smoother. And I suspect if you get a really good quality single speed chain, it's going to last longer.
My single speed commuter bike, which I had in London, probably ran for about 4 years and I did a lot of miles on it. Yeah. I didn't change the chain ever. I practically never cleaned it. I used to lube it every now and again, and it was
lastly, no issues. As ridiculous as it sounds, but the chain is much easier to recycle than a belt drive. I might be wrong, but I'm going to take a punt that metal's easier to get rid of than a carbon belt drive. So generally speaking, I really like the idea. We're still going to do this bike, but
are
I
we?
Think we're going to stick to it. Yes, it's happening.
Is it?
I've been thinking about it nonstop. I've got most of the parts.
You messaged me the other week and you were just like, right, so this bike of yours. I'm like, wait there. I haven't actually agreed to anything. You're like, wait, what do you mean? It's happening.
I'm a little on my size, but it's happening. I'm going to do it.
I think internal rear hubs are underrated by miles. I don't know enough about belt drives, but someone which literally sells them said it maybe isn't a good idea for you. However, how long has Eric hasn't, he hasn't had it that long yet, has he? I hope that what I've been told is wrong and you've made a great decision and your belt drive is wonderful for you.
If I'm not mistaken, to convert it to chain, you can try both. It's probably better to buy a belt and try it first, like that, because if you buy one that can just run a chain, the belt's not possible because the frame needs to be able to split, where you can always convert that back to run a chain if needs be. And it's obviously Canada's different. We're talking over here where it wouldn't be as much snow. It'll be more dirt that you ride in.
Yep. Stephanie in New York City says, I've been told I need to get my hydraulic disc brakes bled once a year. Had it done and it feels exactly the same. Did the mechanic just take my money and do nothing, or is an annual bleed not actually necessary?
I'd say it's not actually necessary in my opinion. I mean, it may be that someone out there has read an in-depth Shimano manual, and in section 4.23, they recommend having their brakes serviced every 12 months or a certain kilometers. The reality is, I don't think it needs to be done. Like, I think if the brakes go spongy, then yeah, maybe there's some air in the system and they need bleeding. And equally, if you're kind of riding on slightly more mountainous terrain where the brakes kind of heat up quite a lot, then they may need... since you can cook the fluid and the brakes may need rebleeding, but I don't think it's every year that it needs doing.
I would, from my experience of disc brakes, you just kind of know when they're not as good as they were. And it's either that the pads are knackered or the lever just ends up pulling significantly further than it did. And that could be bleeding or pads. Mm-hmm. But like, there's always something which has gone, oh, I should get these checked.
Mm-hmm. It's the same in servicing in general. You know, it's like a regular service on a bike is a good thing just in terms of refreshing the grease, just for longevity of the bike. But equally, obviously people ride their bike, like a year is like such a arbitrary number because it depends on how many miles you've done during that period, the conditions you're riding in, et cetera, et cetera. So
I do have at least one bike that has done nothing in a year. So it won't be being serviced.
And the brakes
serviced.
Don't need, yeah, exactly. The brakes definitely don't need doing on it right now.
Okay, next question is from Ruth. best upgrade for a gravel bike to make the front end less harsh over the gravel sections. I'm considering carbon wheels, a suspension fork or stem. The rides I do are normally 50-50 road to gravel.
Carbon wheels are going to give you minimal gains. Your tire pressure is most important, firstly, for without spending money. The stem. The stem is... We sell a range of stems in the shop. Lucas, that one of my friends that I ride with, he gave me a Redshift stem probably about 2.5 years ago. And it was in my locker because I thought that was the biggest gimmick ever. And then I put it on my bike purely because I didn't have a stem. I sold mine to somebody that needed one in a hurry. And I stuck it on. And it's just so good.
It does surprise me how good they are. There's other Cane Creek.
Cane Creek does one as well, yeah, which is good.
Who else? There's another one as well, isn't there? Is it like Magura or someone else?
I don't know.
There's other ones out there. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to get a Redshift one, but it's the one I've used myself and it works really well.
Would you go for suspension stem over fork?
Yes, because it's significantly cheaper and it doesn't require loads of changes to the bike.
It needs no servicing either. It needs no after sales, and you can infinitely change the stiffness with the included spacers if you want to. Suspension is great fork wise, but the problem is going to cost you a lot more. It's maintenance. If money is no object, get a suspension fork, but it's essentially the stem gives you so much already that that's the number one place I'd go to first.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but changing forks also gets weirdly complicated because you have to, well, unless you want to change the handling of your bike, you need to match the angle of the fork plus make sure it all
is compatible. So you need to look at the rake. You need to look at, is your frame set suspension corrected? So essentially, is it built to take a suspension? You can't just stick one on. Well, you can, but you shouldn't just stick it on any bike. And then you need to start looking at, it just becomes a lot more complicated because generally speaking, they're going to come with post-mount brake calipers. Most gravel bikes at the moment have flat mount calipers, so you're going to have to put new calipers on or find dodgy converters. And it's just, start with the stem and see how you go with that.
Well, I guess the other place to start would potentially be tires if the bike already has a wheel set and clearance that can handle large volume tires. Because Ruth could put larger volume tires on, set up tubeless with a super low pressure, and instantly it's going to be more comfortable. Yeah. And then
is that going to be annoying if she's doing half of her riding on a road? Is that going to be significantly worse there?
I did a road ride yesterday with 650B 2.1 inch mountain bike tires set up tubeless, and the bike rides amazing. You know,
comfort is more important than anything else, bizarrely. I think it's going to take a while for the industry to catch on to this, but comfort is the number one thing that you want for 95% of cyclists. It'll make you faster. It'll make you less fatigued. It'll cause less pain. I would definitely get the stem personally. It's the biggest change I've done to my, it sounds ridiculous, the amount of money we spend on bikes. And then that stem is just, yeah, that's the biggest change I've done over anything else.
Linda says, I have what I can only describe as a panic attack if a climb ramps up. I could do a 7% or all day, but if the climb ramps up to say 14% for even a short time, my head says, oh no, I can't do this. I have tried hypnotherapy and it hasn't worked. It's so frustrating. When I get the panics, I either stop or don't even try, or I pedal as fast as I can to try and get up it before I blow up, and I blow up most of the time. Any advice would be much appreciated. I can definitely relate to Linda. There have been times in my past where you're already knackered, you see it start ramping up, and you're like, oh God, I don't know what's going to happen here.
There's things you can do beforehand. So I think firstly, think about bike setup. So have you got easy enough gearing? Because ultimately you can ride, in terms of intensity, and if you're talking about power output and things like that, you can ride at the same intensity on a steeper gradient if you've got an easy enough gear.
I talk about this a lot. Because I always say it, there isn't sufficient gear range on most road bikes for normal people. Mm-hmm. Like there has never been a scenario in my life where I'm going up at a climb and I think I've got too much gear range here. There's too many easy gears. Why have I done this? This is a waste.
Yeah.
And similarly, I've never gone down a hill and gone, I wish I had a harder gear. So like I feel like bikes should be spec'd with easier gears. Mm-hmm. And what you said is a really, really good confidence builder as well, because if the gradient gets really steep and you have the ability to maintain a normal cadence and it be it feel the same amount of effort as something shallower, then you just go, oh, actually this is fine. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good step start. It may be that you've already got really easy gears, in which case then we need to look at other things. I think the other thing in terms of preparation beforehand that I was thinking about was kind of the physical preparation. So I think if you're, at the minute, she said she's kind of comfortable riding a slightly shallower gradient, but what you could look at doing is maybe riding the shallower gradient harder.
Yep.
Or in a bit of a heavier gear to kind of replicate the same feeling of riding a steeper gradient.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And then in terms of, I mean, panic attacks being kind of an extreme case of anxiety, it's like how to address the anxiety and how to kind of preempt that. So anxiety is kind of, in a lot of cases, it'd be like a fear of an unwanted outcome. So in this case, I don't know, without having the conversation, it's difficult to know what she is fearing. So maybe the fear is not getting up the climb or toppling over or something on those lines. So it's recognizing that right now, okay, if she is fearing not being able to complete the climb, well, she's already in that position now and she's experienced not being able to do that. So it's realizing that, okay, you've been through that experience. So, and there's nothing, essentially, it's easy to say, but like there's nothing to fear because you've already experienced it.
Yeah.
So anything better than that, or maybe you get further on the climb, your baseline right now is where your comfort zone is. So if you can extend that by riding slightly further on the climb, let's say it's something, not to fear something you've already experienced, basically.
Yeah.
There's kind of techniques that I've seen or heard people speak about, kind of a higher level in sport, but essentially it's still around that thing of anxiety management. So in fact, just this morning I was watching a reel from Dan Carter, who's famous in the rugby world, kind of arguably one of the best players of all time, but he was a kicker. So like a fly half. So he was taking the kicks. And obviously when you're in the game, there's kind of, you're just in the flow of it, but then there's the moment to take a kick. And then he was talking about it. So all of a sudden you realize that you're stood in front of 80,000 people taking this kick that matters. Mm-hmm. And it's still, I say, although that's like it's a big leap away from turning, just kind of riding a local climb, but it's still the same thing. It's still, there's anxiety being generated and how do you deal with that? So his method was, essentially it was as simple as kind of when he goes back to the kick, it was just a case of kind of feeling his feet and his shoes. And then you'd kind of start to look at the ball, look at where he wants to strike the ball. And essentially it's getting into the process of what you're then going to execute. So it can be like maybe have a trigger in place. So recognize when you're starting to, or when the panic attack is starting, recognize that when that's happening and then try and default to the process you're trying to execute. So it may even be, you can replicate what he's trying to do. I say that feeling in the shoes, and then you start to think about the cadence you're riding at, kind of getting back in control of your breathing. Maybe that's something to think about. And the other point, again, kind of from the sporting world, massive thing that is spoken about by so many people is visualization. So I think it's one of those things that it can get dismissed easily.
Yeah.
But equally, that anyone that I see that's performing at the highest level is doing some form of visualization. So it could be as simple as this climb that you've previously been struggling with, it's visualizing yourself successfully climbing it. How mm-hmm. is it going to feel? How do your muscles feel? How's your breathing during that effort? And there's a friend of mine, he plays for a Premier League football team, and a couple of weeks ago he ended up kind of scoring. We were talking about the process beforehand, and he was saying he literally visualized that moment hundreds of times. So then when it comes to the action itself, he was just in the flow of it. His body felt like he had already done it.
Yeah.
So yeah, again, it's something slightly out there, and I say quite often dismissed, but equally visualization and dreaming and that sort of thing, that's actually a skill that differentiates humans from their kind of ancestors. Mm-hmm. And yet a lot of people don't tap into that ability.
Interesting.
I definitely think one of the things that's said here, which will definitely cause problems, is I either stop and get off, or I pedal as fast as I can to try and get up it before I blow up. Doing that will almost certainly always guarantee blowing up.
Mm-hmm. Especially if your heart rate's already elevated because you're anxious. That's definitely something that takes time and skill to practice, is how to effectively get up a climb, because I'm exactly the same. You panic and you want it to be over, so you spin faster, but you're then using too much cardio too quickly. And one thing that definitely helped me, which you two have mentioned, is getting better gears, because it allows you to pedal slower ultimately, so you're not using your cardio up as much. But I think that you've touched on a good thing, because it's addressing the physical aspects and addressing the mental aspect. And ultimately what's probably happened over a long period of time is each time it hasn't been successful, there's a negative experience created. Mm-hmm. So you have a bank of negative experience and no positive experiences. So you almost have to reframe that to give yourself some easy wins. So like you're saying, they're doing it at a lower percentage harder. That's an easy win because you're replicating it. Even if you can get a turbo trainer and you can practice sort of pedaling through on a harder, again, it's breaking it down to its component parts and successfully managing to get that, so you get some easy wins. So then, you know, when you go back to the climb, you know, you've had these negative experiences, but you've also had some positive experiences to kind of balance it out, and so you can have more confidence to go, I can do this.
Mm-hmm. And even though you kind of touched on it, it's kind of, there's then you create an association with maybe it is just the same climb, you know, and then there's an association with it being related to the climb, and it's not the climb itself, because if it was the climb, every time anyone rode the climb, they'd have the same experience.
Yeah.
So it's not that climb itself. It's recognizing where the anxiety is coming from. It is an internal thing. So perhaps ride somewhere else, train somewhere else, experience some different gradients. And even, I think it can be a bit of a hindrance at times as well. It's advertised as being something useful, but on all of the head units now, Garmin's, Wahoo's, etc., there's a thing that flashes up that tells you the gradient, and it tells you what's coming and all the rest of it. And for some people that could be useful, because okay, you can break it down, but equally if it's like flashes up, oh, it's this gradient, well, then there's that trigger in your head again. So maybe that's starting something. And equally that can be the same with heart rate or power. It's like when you see 185 BPM and you know, oh God, like normally when I'm riding at this, I've only got this long left. And then you start to
second guess it.
Yeah, exactly. You start to kind of get in your own head about that.
I can't do this. Yeah.
This is my limit. Well, no, maybe your limit's something more than that. You just don't know it yet. So it's kind of, potentially not, or trying to dissociate that number with the experience.
Yeah, totally. You can do it, Linda. I believe in you.
Let us know as well. When you get to the top of the climb, we'll have a little celebration for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Next one is from Alexander. It says, without prying too much, how difficult is it financially to run a bike shop? Is it a tough place to be with the cost of living right now?
It's difficult. In the general space, if you do it how traditional bike shops were run back in the day, yes. Because generally speaking, you need to find premises, you have to pay your rent, you have to pay loads of extra fees. And then there's the aspect of you need to get brands. Unfortunately, when you're new to the game and you're not, haven't been doing it for a while, they're going to expect you to do buy-ins. You also then have the struggle of if there's other shops in your area that already have the brands you want to sell, you can't get them.
Well, can you explain what a buy-in is?
So bizarrely, it's changing at the moment, but historically, for instance, if you wanted one of the top tier brands like Cannondale, for instance, back in the day, they could come with any kind of offer at the beginning of the year and say to you, to sell our brand this year, you have to spend £100,000 in stocking in the bikes and you'll get a set margin. If you want more margin, you need to spend more money. So everything's buying. If you want to buy a set type of wheels, they will say for some brands, 5 wheel sets off the bat, you need to take day one before you can sell the product. And that becomes more and more. It's just to kind of show your commitment to the brand.
So ultimately you're saying you'd have to buy a minimum amount of units to be able to
sell
even
stuff.
Have access to that yes. product.
That is changing now because some of the brands are struggling and they need to sell products. But then there's other, some distributors will start off with a, you need to spend £500 on your first order, otherwise you can't open an account. Mm-hmm. There's loads of these things. And then the downside to this, you don't really know yet what you're going to sell. So if you're going to start as a workshop-based shop, that's a bit easier because most of the main brands we need spares for will just give you accounts and there's no buy-in. And you can start with that and then build it up from there. So yeah, it is difficult.
I think one of the things that your shop does well is you have, you're not trying to do everything. You have defined a niche. And from an outsider perspective, I would say that is higher end custom builds.
Yes.
So, you know, you're choosing your frame set, you're choosing your group set, X, Y, Z, and it's not entry level by any means. And I think that you're quite unapologetic about that because you have managed to define your niche in being high end builds. You can focus your time into that and you are able to get customers from around the UK yeah. that come to you as a specialist. And that's almost what people need in any sector, actually. It doesn't even just go for bike yeah. shops.
It is more difficult because every bike sale is a long conversation.
Yeah.
And every product needs to be ordered. The bike needs to be assembled. It's not just getting a box, taking it out, or picking something off the floor. But I think everybody forgets everything cycling shop, doesn't matter what business is, same as basic economics. The things that sinks businesses, generally speaking, is overheads. So just be aware, whatever you do is the lower you can keep your overheads, the easier, because that means if your overheads is minimal and you don't have a good month, you don't have to worry about lending money to pay wages or rent or rates. So try and keep it
lean.
Keep it lean. That's what we did. So during the pandemic, I have one, James works with me and that's it. It's just the two of us. So yes, our time is a bit more difficult because we can't just do whatever we want because we need to focus on a few things. That makes it a bit easier for us. And then the second thing is being overstocked. But overstock's only a problem if the stock becomes dead stock and you can't sell it. The other thing is, marketing-wise, I think there's a massive misconception. Yes, there's always deviations, but generally speaking, you can split the bike industry into different categories. There's your road category, there's your mountain biking category, and there's your commuting category. And they are might cross over. Some people do everything, but some people focus on that. But to market for all three, I feel, is impossible. Together as one campaign, you'd have to do three marketing campaigns.
When you say road, do you actually mean drop bar?
Drop bar, yeah. So because gravel falls into the road side of
yeah,
things.
Yeah, it does,
yes.
yeah.
And because mountain bikes will want something completely different and do mm-hmm. different things. And I see this with industry wheel manufacturers because now the mountain biking market is trying to get in the gravel market, but they're struggling because yes, it's easy to sell to the mountain bikers, but to the roadies don't know their product. And they just assume that because their product's big in mountain biking, the roadie should do it. It doesn't work like that. So that's why as a shop, we just decided because of limited capabilities, we are just going to focus on what we're good at and what we know and not do things that we don't. So essentially, we try and just sell stuff that we believe in. And that makes it a bit easier. But it is difficult. The downside is we've done it for a while now and we're lucky because we've sold quite a few things. So we can ask distributors to lower the buy-ins and things like that for certain products because we can sell. But yeah, it's a difficult arm wrestling with every single negotiation is don't just accept the fact that if somebody tells you you need to buy £100,000 worth of stuff, just say no, don't do it.
Your shop is actually really interesting because you don't have bikes on display. The only bikes on display are your bikes and bikes that are probably in servicing.
Yeah.
You know, you haven't got stock, you haven't got stuff sitting on rails. Someone comes in and says they want to buy a bike, you give them options, you buy it in, you build it, you sell it to them.
That's I think technically speaking, we're not a bike shop.
What are you then? Well, ice cream makers.
We're custom build, but we do custom builds and we do aftercare service for it. Yes, we take in a few extra services where we can to try and help people out, but generally speaking, we focus on after service. So we sell somebody a bike and we try and look after them afterwards. So at the moment, I've got this massive craze of trying to build all my bikes in such a way that they need minimal servicing. So the customer wins by not having to bring in for servicing, but I also win by having a bit more free time to do more marketing to hopefully sell more bikes because we don't have bikes on show, it's much harder to actually sell a bike because you can't test ride any of our bikes. You can't see anything really. You have to kind of just
have faith.
Have faith that we know what we're doing. The plus side is, but it didn't start like this. We started by doing mostly servicing. We were servicing loads of bikes and then did custom builds as a hobby. And it just became to a point where we started selling more custom builds than what servicing
generated in revenue.
Yeah, generated. Yeah. We worked it out last year, for instance, servicing. We were servicing quite a lot of bikes, but it equated to something like 5% of our turnover, but took up 95% of our time, which is a failing business model.
Mm.
So you need to look at it. Every single thing you do, you need to look into like economical, what works, what doesn't work.
I think for someone listening to this that has an interest in starting a bike shop, I think just because you've done it doesn't mean that it can be done. You are an anomaly in this space. You've spent a long time developing your relationships with distributors and industry people, like really putting a lot of effort into that so that you can do things like buying lower numbers of things to set up your custom shop. So like ultimately your business model is not the sort of thing that someone could just start from scratch overnight.
The other thing is we're lucky. I was lucky that I ended up in Newcastle, which is sheer luck. Newcastle is a bit of a dead zone in terms of our closest outside of the city's competition is Edinburgh, the Lake District, Hull, Yorkshire essentially. So it's not like if you did in London, shops that do similar stuff to us, there'll be about 10 or 15 of them all across the road from each other. So they all have to compete for the premium brands. Where Newcastle's got a lot of bike shops, but generally they all do traditional things, which is good. It's probably more needed. There's a much bigger market for that than there is for what we do. But we've been lucky enough to not have a lot of competition up here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult thing. If you're going to open a bike shop, just be aware that it's a fun job. You're not doing actual work. I know there'll be stress and things like that, but we drink coffee, talk about bikes, build bikes, ride bikes, work on bikes. So you have to factor that in. So you're not going to make millions. All of the ones that have tried like Wiggle have failed and lost millions. But your quality of life is better. I mean, I have no social life outside of work because I don't need to have a social life outside of work.
What do you mean? We've got a secret golf club.
Yes, but that's once every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's fun, but I mean, like, it's not, yeah. Sorry.
It doesn't sound like it's fun.
It's competition, that. That's, you know, like, we're going to go to the PGA Tour and make actual money. It's a fun job if you do it right. But, yeah, just be focused on, yeah, pick a segment that you want to do, something you can actually work. Don't try and be everything to everybody. It just doesn't work.
So next up is Justin, and he says, I'm 17 years old, and my question is, how do I get a job in a bike shop when you have little to no experience?
Generally speaking, working in a bike shop, most bike shops, you'll have two different roles. So either you're going to work workshop related as a mechanic, or you're going to work sales related, front of house, essentially. So the two different methods can be different. Workshop, bizarrely, is the easier route in because you can go and do a course like SciTech, or the one I recommend is Velotech. And you can get a qualification. You can also do apprenticeships and things like that. You can come in as a qualified mechanic. There is the alternative way, which people don't like doing, is going to work in a shop as an apprentice or help out on Saturdays just so they get to know you. That's the way I started. I did 5 years for free in a bike shop every single day after school. Every free minute I was in there learning, helping out, doing stuff. And that's just how I got the job. Even they used to tease me saying, every day I asked for a job and they kept saying no. Why would we pay you when you're doing it for free anyway already? But yeah, I assume that's not legal anymore. But yeah, that's how I got in. The other way, what I would say is if you're going for sales side of things, find a few of your local bike shops that you like and then see what brands they sell. And I would recommend studying up everything you can on those brands. So that if they sell Giants, for instance, find out about all the current models. Find what they're fitted to. Write yourself a CV and just go and speak to them in the shop. Explain to them, like, you know, you've done all of this. Can you have a couple of trial shifts if they need
something? Demonstrate that skill or that knowledge.
Just expect a job. Go and show them why you should be. I think the cycling industry has fallen into a trap a bit of where people are servers and not selling. Not selling is not the right word, but like be knowledgeable about the product.
You mean like experts, don't
you?
Yeah,
expert. Yeah, in the sense. And it's not difficult because all information is online. You can find out all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Go and speak to them, but just show a bit of what's the word? Initiative.
I'm a big believer that all skills can be learnt, and you should practice those skills. So, for example, if you want to be able to sell bikes in a bike shop, practice. Like, get your brother, your sister, your auntie, your grandfather, whatever, and just be like, right, I'm going to try and sell you a bike.
Yeah.
And then you get to practice that skill, do it out loud, and also demonstrate or rehearse some of that knowledge that you've got.
The other thing at the moment is, if you're going to want to become a mechanic, still learn the sales skills, because it's required. A lot of mechanics back in the day were proud of being awkward and not speaking to customers and things, but speaking to the customer is probably the main thing you can do, because as a mechanic, you're going to have to explain to people why you have to replace stuff on their bike or do things, and essentially that's value to the bike shop. Lastly, I would say, we will be hiring somebody new in the shop at some point, and we need somebody that's going to bring out something extra. So for instance, I need somebody who can do a bit of digital marketing, who can do the Instagram reels or photos, or kind of bring something extra to kind of elevate the shop. Shops at the moment are suffering, so you need to start thinking, what can you add? Like, what kind of extra marketing, and how can you help get more customers in?
That's true, but that's almost a different role, isn't it?
To be fair, Justin's 17, and as we know, all bike shops are run by old farts. Yeah. So it's very easy. He's going to know social media inside out. So we can just get in there and be like, look, have you heard of Instagram? No? Oh, well, let me tell you about it.
Yeah, that's true. But that's the thing. Just bring something extra. Make it worthwhile. Show them that by hiring you, they are going to make more money and they're going to be able to afford your wage. You are going to be worth being there. I think that's the most important thing. Don't just show up and do the bare minimum.
Question from Matt. Do you have any recommendations for sources of information regarding training and getting fit for older cyclists 50 plus?
There's a book called The Midlife Cyclist.
There you go, Matt. Get that book.
Straight to the point.
Question from Aaron. Loving the podcast lately, especially your attitude towards otherwise dumbass, toughen up male sports stuff. I'm a psychologist and training to be a psychotherapist, and nearly ended in an eating disorder myself when I still trained for races a few years ago. As a coach, is it a topic James approaches with his clients?
It's not necessarily something I force a conversation on, but when I do have conversations regarding weight, it's kind of what we touched on earlier. I make sure they're clear on a strategy and that the strategy is something that's sustainable. And I think the other point I'd make is I really want to get to the crux of why that is their ambition, why they feel that needs to happen. So if it's because they feel that, they want to, like, obviously there's the watts per kilo formula, which is thrown around a lot and is in some ways a lot of people kind of use that as a benchmark of performance.
Like, I want to be 5 watts per kilo.
Exactly. That's the the arbitrary figure that a lot of people tend to try and target. And obviously a part of that formula is weight. But equally, it depends on what they're targeting. So I make it clear that, okay, if the why is because they want high watts per kilo, well, why do you want the watts per kilo as well? So it's like, okay, well, I just want that figure to be bigger for the sake of it because that's going to make me a stronger cyclist. Well, what are you actually preparing for? Are you preparing to go and ride in the Alps where it would be more beneficial? Are you preparing for a Zwift race where, again, maybe it's more beneficial? Or are you preparing for the rest of cycling, which in fact would benefit from more raw power? And in fact, what we're better focused on is optimizing training for that rather than kind of focusing on this real specific area. And I'd say, I think if we established that the person I'm speaking with would benefit from losing some weight, and it seems like they're in a position where they could do so whilst still being healthy. It's just, I say, just coming up with the right strategy for that. So kind of presenting them with the right processes and say, making sure that isn't a routine that's based on restriction, because I say a lot of people kind of default to that. It's like, all of a sudden I want to lose some weight, therefore I'm going to start going out and endurance rides fasted and doing things like that, and it's that just isn't productive essentially. So
there has for a long time been an obsession with training fasted, and if you are training for performance, it doesn't make sense to do your training compromised. Mm-hmm. And that was like on one of the things we discussed previously, you referenced Will Gerling essentially talking about Will Gerling being the professional nutritionist, ultimately going, you fuel your sessions. And if you do want to lose weight, you do it when you're not training rather than when you are. And it from my experiences, that's probably a mistake that I have made in the past as well, not eating enough whilst training.
Yeah, I think when it comes to fasted training, there's a bit of a lack of understanding at times, because even if you do, let's say the normal thing would be like a pre-breakfast ride, well, in that state you're still going to have glycogen in your system. You store glycogen in your liver and your muscles. If you've been eating carbohydrates previous to that, so you're going to store a certain amount of calories in glycogen in your system. Then when you go and ride, your body's still going to be tapping into that, so you're not actually truly in a fasted state anyway. Yeah. So it kind of comes back to that thing of understanding why with the sessions.
You sort of touched on it in the last podcast we did, but you sort of mentioned about it depends on the person, in terms of if you know they are the sort of person who has like perfectionist tendencies, mm-hmm. or is very obsessed with numbers, then mm-hmm. you know, making sure they're not rigorously calorie counting and stuff mm-hmm. is probably something.
Yeah, definitely avoiding creating those unconstructive routines is something to something to be aware of. And I'd say it's not that, like, I think people can go too far the other way and then it's like all of a sudden any sort of weight loss or that side of things can then become a negative thing, and it's like, oh yeah, it can be unconstructive. It doesn't need to be. It's just the method that you're the process in which you're trying to lose weight needs to be something that is actually healthy and sustainable. And yeah.
So this was a long question from Daniel. I've read through it fully and I've paraphrased it. So he says, at the end of last spring, I developed post-COVID fatigue after attempting my first bikepacking race. Do you have any tips around how to pace training when returning from an illness?
So I think there's like a balance between listening to the medical advice and then also listening to your body. So it's kind of learning if there's any kind of intensity or duration or combination of training sessions that trigger a flare up or kind of like abnormal levels of fatigue. And being aware of that. And essentially, when it comes to building, it's like, let's say for example, in like lower intensity riding seems to be manageable. It's okay, right? How do you progress using that? So it could be number of training sessions. It could be the duration of the training sessions. It could be stitching back-to-back days together. Or looking at other forms of training. Actually, I was helping my sister recently. So she's preparing to do her first ever marathon. And then, so marathon's in May, and she had a really bad hip injury kind of December, January time, to the point where she couldn't walk, let alone run. And then her method of trying to get back into training was to just run, or like to run for a shorter distance, and it just kept on flaring up. So I was like, okay, firstly, go and get some medical advice. So in that case, it was go and see a physio, go and see an osteo, get an idea of what's actually going on. Okay, there's tightness here, there's areas that need strengthening there. And then essentially adapting the plan. So it's like, okay, think about doing strength training instead. Think about doing a different form of cardio. And then, yes, it doesn't feel like running. It doesn't feel like you're working towards that goal, but the reality is you are, just the training looks slightly different. So yeah, it's potentially a case of looking at, maybe different forms of training, but also, I say, just being clear on the on the bike stuff, what feels good, what feels like your body's responding well to it. And if there's anything where, say afterwards, I think that's actually another conversation I always have with people is, how do you feel before the session? Do you feel ready for it? Do you feel motivated? Because that can be a sign of fatigue and things like that. How do you feel during the session? So does the intensity feel like it normally would, or does it feel like it's extra work, or maybe that picture changes during the session? So say sometimes if there's a bit of fatigue there, you kind of feel a bit sluggish at the start and then you kind of ride into it and feel better. And then equally, how do you feel after the session? Do you feel like you've ridden for 10 hours and in fact you've done one, or do you feel better afterwards? Do you feel like you've got more energy, your body's responding well, you feel hungry? Looking at those signs as well. So really tuning into that. And like I touched on the previous podcast, that's kind of real, the focus is on self-awareness. How is my body responding? And not necessarily coming up with a really long plan and schedule of how things are going to look in 2, 3, 4 weeks time, maybe going week by week, session by session, and adapting like that.
Oh, I also have potentially something that might help on the topic of long COVID and post-COVID fatigue. It's something that my mum had really bad. She had very, very bad long COVID and severe fatigue, and something that there's a growing body of evidence that basically shows that it, vagus nerve stimulation can help with chronic fatigue. So your vagus nerve is like your body's information superhighway. It carries signals from your brain to various organs. And yes, there's lots of studies that are being done at the moment that show that non-invasive vagus nerve stimulation over several weeks can improve fatigue and reduce levels of inflammation in patients. So basically, after exercise, stuff that can stimulate your vagus nerve is loud humming, like a Buddhist om. Yep, or loud gargling with water, or loud singing even. Anything that can stimulate your vocal cords in turn can stimulate your vagus nerve and is apparently proven to help with fatigue. James, we were talking about this earlier, and you were saying you can buy a really expensive device that apparently stimulates your vagus nerve. Don't do that. Don't do that. But ultimately, anything that can loudly stimulate your vocal cords.
Maybe that's why I feel so great after driving in the car on my own, because of all of the aggressive singing that I do whilst doing that.
Last one is from Josh, who says, I think the world needs to know why Nick thinks metal bikes are better than carbon. First of all, is that true? You think metal bikes are better than carbon bikes?
Yes. Not all metal bikes, though.
Okay.
But generally, all metal bikes. It's a difficult thing to say because you can get bad metal bikes.
Yeah.
I'm not saying expensive is good. I'm just saying made with like thinking it through and knowing what they're doing.
So why do you think they're better?
It's difficult. It's one of those age-old things nobody can put their finger on. But Jimmy's finding it out at the moment as well.
I really am.
I don't know. It just rides nicer. Alloy is slightly still harsh, but steel and titanium and well-made ones. Just, I don't know. There's all these stories about vibration dampening and resonance and things like that. But they just ride nicer. The other aspect of it is you're not as precious. So I think it's a subconscious thing of when I ride one of them, I'm not worried if I drop it, if it gets a scratch and ding. And you just tend to kind of use it as a tool more. I had a camera when I got into all of this stuff, and I bought a camera, and it was so precious with it and keeping it in a little bag and case and just never used it. And when I got to a point where I was like, I'm just going to stick it in my pocket and use it whenever I'm going to use it. Now all of a sudden I really enjoy it. A couple of scratches. I almost encourage people when you get a bike with that's made out of metal, drop the thing on day one, get it scratched, and then you'll enjoy it more afterwards. Where carbon is just not that thing. And that constant worry in the back of my head is a trust there. And I know they are strong and they do last and they are good, but it's just that, I don't know, it just feels nicer.
So I've ridden a lot of bikes over the years with all possible, the only thing I haven't ridden is titanium. So I've gone loads of alloy bikes, loads of steel bikes, and loads of carbon bikes. And I don't know why, but I just find carbon bikes boring. They're just
it's
dull.
Weird. It's something, I don't know, something in the ride. The other aspect is steel is lovely. A steel bike is excellent. I prefer titanium because the corrosion resistance is better for me. And it feels slightly more durable than going stainless steel. Stainless steel, lovely bike to ride, but the other thing is the weight penalty. Everybody seems to miss the point completely. The weight penalty is massive, generally speaking.
Isn't
at all. Let's say where it becomes massive is similar to like these aero gain numbers. So a good carbon frame is going to be 700 to 1,000 grams, and a good steel or titanium frame is going to be 1,600 to 2 kilos. So yes, that's double. But that double is nothing compared to the system weight. So on a full bike, that's going to be very little. And then you need to remember you on the bike as well. So for the average rider, which obviously I'm going to generalize over here, but let's say you weigh 85 kilos, what I weigh. I mean, it's less than 1% we're talking about over here. It just doesn't really matter. The gains you get from being more comfortable, but also just the subliminal thing. Some stuff feels better. There's a thing with carbon might feel faster. but it's perceived the same thing as a go-kart is gonna feel faster than a Rolls-Royce. I keep saying this, but it's just a fact.
I don't even think it does feel faster. I think if you have a good dialed in steel bike,
the comfort,
it still feels fast. It feels amazing.
I implore everybody to try a metal bike. It doesn't have to be expensive. Just if you're gonna go cheap, try steel. You get cheaper steel bikes now all everywhere. Aluminium is a bit of a anomaly. They are still harsh. I don't class them in the category of steel and titanium. Titanium is really expensive, but at least try a steel bike. It is just, I don't know what to say, or like, you can't quantify it. It is just...
Yeah, it's odd.
You ride loads of bikes, it's just, it's nicer.
Yeah.
And then the fatigue thing and stuff is, I honestly believe you will get, if I got off my titanium JGM now and I rode a carbon gravel bike with the same tire clearance and everything, the carbon bike might feel faster, but then you have to kind of start quantifying, does it feel faster because of that kind of road feel, similar to the go-kart Rolls-Royce analogy? And yes, I think it will. And then I think over time, because that tiny mini vibrations rattling will cause a lot more fatigue. So over an actual ride, it'll be slower. But in your mind, you might convince yourself on this one hill that you rode fast, it's faster, but it isn't really. It's the same as like higher tire pressures feel faster, but if you do a gravel ride, trust me, it's not going to be faster. It's going to be a lot slower. They've proven this, even on the road, lower tire pressures are faster. It just doesn't feel it. And the problem is everybody base everything off feel. This is where metal's weird, because it feels nicer on an actual ride, yeah.
That's all for this week. Remember, you can send your questions and stories and fun stuff to wildonespodcast@cademedia.co.uk. Join us next week when Francis returns from his travels. Please like and subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. Please give us a 5-star review if you are listening. Thank you and see you next time. Goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.